Les conférences du Collège de France.
Bonjour et bienvenue à toutes et à tous. Nous avons le plaisir d'accueillir aujourd'hui deux collègues japonais de l'Université de Tokyo, tous les deux. Donc, le professeur Nakajima Takahiro ce matin et la professeure Shimazu Naoko cet après-midi, qui va nous parler de diplomatie, de l'histoire de la diplomatie japonaise. Ce matin, donc, nous recevons le professeur Nakajima, qui est non seulement un très bon collègue, mais aussi un ami de longue date. J'arrive même plus à me rappeler quand nous nous sommes rencontrés, mais c'était, j'ai l'impression, dans une vie antérieure, parce que c'était à une époque où mon mari était encore en vie et où notre bon collègue de l'EHESS, Joël Toraval, était aussi en vie. Et maintenant, ils sont tous les deux décédés depuis de nombreuses années. Mais nous sommes encore là et toujours amis. Alors, le professeur Nakajima a eu la très grande gentillesse de m'inviter à plusieurs reprises à Tokyo. Et nous savons tous que aller au Japon, c'est toujours une expérience merveilleuse. Ce qui est évidemment paradoxal, c'est que quand nous allons au Japon, nous avons l'impression d'être, dans un espace-temps, de très 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 de découvertes merveilleuses, etc., de détente totale. Alors que nos collègues japonais nous disent que nous et eux, ils sont toujours en réunion, qu'ils mènent une vie extrêmement stressante. Donc, alors j'imagine que l'inverse est vrai aussi quand ils viennent à Paris. Que c'est la détente pour eux et nous sommes dans le stress intégral. Alors, le professeur Nakajima est actuellement donc professeur de philosophie chinoise. C'est donc un sinologue japonais et il enseigne également la philosophie. On pourrait dire mondial. C'est quelqu'un qui parle plusieurs langues. Aujourd'hui, je pense qu'il a choisi de nous parler en anglais, mais il parle aussi français, chinois. Il enseigne tout cela à l'Institut d'études avancées sur l'Asie, à l'Université de Tokyo, institut dont il est le directeur. Et il est également éditeur donc aux presses universitaires de Tokyo. Principaux centres d'intérêt sont sur la philosophie chinoise et la philosophie japonaise du point de vue de cette philosophie mondiale. En tout cas, il y a chez lui en fait une volonté d'aller au-delà d'une philosophie très eurocentrée ou très occidentalo-centrée. Donc il va toujours chercher en fait l'universel à partir donc des philosophies locales, en passant par l'élaboration donc de concepts autochtones. Alors, il a de très très nombreuses publications. Je peux vous dire que tous ses collègues japonais se demandent quand est-ce qu'il dort, parce qu'en fait, il a une puissance de travail absolument phénoménale. Alors, j'en cite juste quelques-uns. Donc, en japonais, publié aux presses universitaires de Tokyo, donc une relecture des pensées japonaises modernes en 2023. Une histoire de la philosophie chinoise, publiée en 2022, ainsi que une praxis de la coexistence État et religion, également en 2022, La réverbération de la philosophie chinoise. Alors ça, je ne sais pas trop ce que ça veut dire, mais enfin bon, il va nous l'expliquer sans doute. Langage et politique. La philosophie en crise, discours de l'imagination en 2021. L'histoire de la philosophie mondiale qu'il a coédité avec plusieurs collègues en 2020 chez Chikuma Shobo et en anglais donc coédité avec notre collègue canado-américain Roger Ames, Zhuangzi and the Happy Fish. Zhuangzi est le poisson heureux, hein, le poisson, en 2015, aux presses universitaires de Hawaï, etc. Donc je m'arrête là parce que sinon le professeur Nakajima n'aura pas le temps de parler. Et donc je lui laisse tout de suite la parole donc, pour cette conférence sur la sinologie japonaise moderne comme discours impérial. Donc là, vous percevez tout de suite que le professeur Nakajima est dans une perspective critique. Je ne crois pas me tromper en disant que c'est quelqu'un qui connaît très bien ce que les Américains appellent la « French Theory ». Et en particulier Jacques Derrida, hein, ce qui l'a beaucoup inspiré dans son travail. Voilà.
Bonjour à tous. Merci beaucoup, la professeure Han Chang. C'était l'introduction très sympa pour moi. Je m'appelle Takahiro Nakajima, directeur de l'Institut de la culture orientale à l'Université de Tokyo. Aujourd'hui, désolé, j'ai choisi l'anglais en place de français. Excusez-moi. All right, so today I'm going to talk about the modern Japanese sinology as an imperial discourse. So, this is a photo taken by me some weeks ago. This is a monument of Hattori Unokichi, one of the major actors in modern Japanese sinology. Yeah, so this photo was taken in Nihonmatsu City in Fukushima. Yeah, Fukushima was a place which a fight against the Meiji government. So that is why the younger generation from Fukushima was prohibited in promotion in the bureaucratic system. They were excluded. So then they went to the academia, including Hattori. Okay? So this is the outline of today's talk of mine. So this outline is divided in two parts for Hattori and for Takase. All right, so today I'd like to examine the characteristics of Chinese philosophy in modern Japan by focusing on two contemporary sinologists from the same generation. One is here, Hattori Unokichi. So one is Hattori Unokichi in the left photo, and another is Takase Takejiro in the right photo. Two of them were the first and second generation educated in the Tokyo Imperial University era from 1886 to 1947. In 1905, a Department of Religious Studies was established at the College of Letters of Tokyo Imperial University. In the congratulatory address delivered at the 25th anniversary celebration in 1930, Inoue Tetsujiro, this person, made the following statement. I was the first to use the term Eastern philosophy. Likewise, it was also I who used the term Western philosophy. So this is Inoue who invented Toyo and Seiyo in Japanese. So today I dare to translate them into Eastern and Western. Yeah, sometimes we can translate them into Oriental and Occidental, but maybe I think we had better translate them into Eastern and Western. Inoue does claim that he was the first to introduce the concepts of Western philosophy and Eastern philosophy, which continue to exert a significant influence to this day. This took place around 1883, when Inoue began his lectures on the history of Eastern philosophy. The structure of the philosophy-related disciplines at the University of Tokyo at that time was closely related to this development. So, this is a red gate from our university. When the University of Tokyo was founded in 1877, so 2 years later, we will celebrate its 150 years anniversary year. The Faculty of Letters was established by reorganizing the Tokyo Kaisei School, which was established in 1872 for the learning of Western cultures. The Faculty of Letters was structured into two departments. The first division, which included history, philosophy, and political science, and the second division, which included Japanese and Chinese literature. So, Chinese philosophy and Indian philosophy were classified under the Japanese and Chinese literature division of the second division. It was an odd situation, but Chinese philosophy was marginalized already. Through the multiple reorganizations, the three-department system of philosophy, history, and literature was established in 1904 and maintained during the Tokyo Imperial University era. Within this structure, Chinese philosophy and Indian philosophy were incorporated into the Department of Philosophy, resulting in a division where philosophy was designated for Western philosophy, while Chinese philosophy and Indian philosophy were designated for the study of Eastern philosophy. Due to this academic structuring, the interdisciplinary research conducted by the first generation of scholars, such as Inoue Tetsujiro, gradually became regionally divided and specialized. If you see these two figures, if you see the renaming from Tetsugakukai Zashi, left side, Jeishui Hui, Zaji, Journal of Philosophical Association, established in 1887, to Tetsugaku Zashi, right side, Jeishui Zaji, Hui Kai was omitted, Journal of Philosophy in 1892, they excluded disciplines such as psychology, ethics, anthropology, linguistics, economy, and so on, and focus on philosophy. Afterwards, Eastern philosophy would be marginalized, and only so-called pure philosophy based on Western philosophy remained in the journal, Tetsugaku Zashi. Okay? In this context, Chinese philosophy classified under Eastern philosophy was regarded mainly as sinology or ethics, which would contribute to the nation, that is, Japanese Empire. The next generation of scholars who studied under Inoue Tetsujiro, Inoue lectured on modern Chinese philosophy, and Shimada Chōrei, who taught sinology, especially Chinese classical studies, was represented by Hattori and Takase. These two scholars were of the same generation as Oyanagi Shigeta, sinology of Taoism, and Nishida Kitaro, very famous philosopher in modern Japan, the founder of modern Japanese pure philosophy, and slightly older than Kuaki Genyoku, whom almost of all Japanese forgot, a philosopher of Neo-Kantianism and the Shunzu. First, let us consider Hattori. Hattori was not only famous for his sinology of Eastern ethics, but for a scholar who stood out for his international scope. In 1899, he set out on a four-year study abroad, abroad trip to Qing, China and Germany. In 1900, he encountered the Boxer Rebellion, during which he experienced a siege alongside other Japanese individuals and the Japanese military. The details of this experience are recorded in his book, Beijing Siege Diary, this one. He returned to Japan temporarily in 1900, but soon departed for Germany, where he studied for a year and a half from 1901 at the University of Leipzig and the University of Berlin. At the University of Leipzig, he studied under August Conradi. Conradi was a professor of philology and comparative linguistics, two of the most prominent academic fields of the 19th century, focusing on Sanskrit, Tibetan, and Chinese, among other languages. Modern Japanese sinology increasingly leaned toward philology, not philosophy, reflecting the centrality of the discipline in the 19th century. Conradi's predecessor was Hans-Georg Konon von der Gabelentz, a scholar of comparative linguistics who published Chinese grammar and linguistics. He is also known as the mentor of Ueda Kazutoshi, a prominent Japanese linguist. One of von der Gabelentz's students at the University of Leipzig was Wilhelm Grube, this person, a sinologist of Chinese Neo-Confucianism and Chinese literature. Von der Gabelentz also translated Zhou Dongyi's Taiji Tu Shuo explanation of the diagram of the supreme ultimate, through which Grube learned about song studies. Hattori, in turn, studied under Grube at the University of Berlin. After returning to Japan, Hattori once again traveled to China, this time to teach at the Imperial University of Peking. This picture shows the Imperial University of Peking. In Chinese, Jinshi Da Shui Tang, established in 1890 and re-established in 1902. The predecessor of Peking University. He did not return to Japan until 1909, spending a total of 10 years abroad, engaged in research and education. An important episode in his international academic engagement was his invitation to Harvard University in 1914. Alongside the religious studies scholar Anesaki Masaharu, during this visit, he donated approximately 1,600 Japanese books, forming the first East Asian studies collection at Harvard University. Furthermore, in 1926, he also served as the president of this one. Keijo Imperial University in Korea. So this is a development of Imperial University system in Japan to colonize Korea. Okay. Furthermore, in 1926, he also served as the president further demonstrating his extensive international experience. Hattori's central concern in Chinese philosophy was Confucianism. But what is this Confucianism? He firmly rejected the notion of Confucianism as a religion, instead emphasizing Confucianism as a system of morality. So if you ask, what is Confucianism to Chinese scholars? Almost of all them reply to you, it must be ethics, morality, education. Nobody refers to religion so far. But in the modern era, there was a movement of religionization of Confucianism in China. So this stance was shaped in contrast to contemporary developments in China, where Kanye West and others were advocating for the religious transformation of Confucianism under the name of Konjiao. So Kanye West and his disciple. This movement sought to redefine Confucianism This movement sought to redefine Confucianism as a religion akin to Christianity, establishing it as the spiritual backbone of modern China. So they knew that, in Europe, they say, we are entering the secularized world. But in fact, Europe still kept the very strong religious background of Christianity. So we should invent a new type of religiosity in China. That was the idea of Kanye West and his disciples. So it was proposed during the 100 Days Reform in 1898 and was put into practice in the early 1910s. During the early years of the Republic of China. However, it failed to gain widespread support and soon declined. Hattori, fully aware of this movement, took an entirely opposing stance, advocating for a non-religious version of Confucianism. Confucianism as morality rather than religion. His argument was most explicitly articulated in his interpretation of the following passage from the Analects. So you can see the original text of the analect here or in the right part. Confucius fell seriously ill. Tzu Lu wished to offer prayers. Confucius said, "Is there such a practice?" Tzu Lu replied, "Yes. In the eulogy, it is said, one prays to the spirits above and below." Confucius said, "I have been praying for a long time." Traditional interpretations suggest that Tzu Lu, concerned about Confucius' illness, sought to pray to the gods of heaven and earth for his master's recovery. However, Confucius declined the offer, implying that such prayers were unnecessary. While this general understanding remained widely accepted, the scholarly debate centered on how to interpret Confucius' final statement, "I have been praying for a long time." Hattori interpreted this phrase as a declaration that he had always acted in accordance with the virtues of the gods of heaven and earth, and therefore there was no need for him to pray now simply because he had fallen ill. In other words, Hattori argued that rather than literally engaging in prayer, Confucius asserting that his actions had always been aligned with the virtues of the heavens and the spirits. Since he had already been living in accordance with these principles, there was no need for additional prayers. While this interpretation was based on the commentaries of Kong Anguo and Zhu Xi, Hattori explicitly framed his reading in opposition to the interpretation put forth by Kang Youwei and the Confucian Church. According to Hattori, Kang Youwei and his followers had deliberately distorted this passage to justify their religious transformation of Confucianism. He argued that the Confucian Church reinterpreted Confucius' words in order to establish prayer as a central ritual in their version of Confucianism, claiming that in the so-called Confucian religion, prayer was considered the most essential ritual. Furthermore, he noted that they deliberately misinterpreted Confucius' statement to mean that Confucius had actually engaged in prayer. In response, Hattori firmly rejected this religious framing of Confucianism, asserting that while practically all religions today regard prayer as a fundamental practice, Confucius utterly rejected it. Thus, Hattori maintained that Confucianism, or what he called Confucian teaching, was fundamentally non-religious and did not include prayer, directly countering the religious reinterpretations proposed by Kang Youwei and the Confucian Church. In short, the Confucian teaching that Hattori proposed was an ethical and moralized version of Confucianism, which had originally been religious in ancient China. In the New Outline of Eastern Ethics, this book, Hattori argued that Confucius transformed Confucianism from an ethnic doctrine or folk doctrine into a universal doctrine, allowing it to extend not only to East Asia, including Japan, but also to the West. Furthermore, he asserted that in Japan, Confucian teaching had been assimilated directly into indigenous thought, Shintoism, without experiencing any ideological conflicts. He then went on to state, "Therefore, I believe that in China, there is Rujiao, Confucianism, but no Gongzijiao, Koshikyo, Confucian teaching, While in Japan, there is Confucian teaching, but no Confucianism. A very complicated statement. But why was this possible? According to Hattori, the reason lay in the fact that Confucianism was still religious, whereas Confucian teaching had become purely rational and ethical, thereby losing its religious characteristics. In other words, Confucianism as Confucian teaching acquired universality by transforming itself into philosophy or ethics. If this was the case, then religious elements such as prayer had to be eliminated from Confucian teaching at all costs. By doing so, Confucian teaching could be universally accepted, and Japan, rather than China, could promote it. Behind Hattori's emphasis on philosophy or ethics in Confucian teaching lay a desire to elevate Japan as an empire striving toward universality. Chen Weifeng, Taiwanese scholar, analyzed the consequences of Hattori's view of Confucian teaching as follows. Hattori passively sought to remain within the framework of the orthodoxy of the emperor system, while actively as an educator and an intellectual, he was driven by a strong sense of mission to support the spiritual order of the emperor system, state. And he thus chose to align himself with political power, as can be seen from the foundations of his thought, his theory of Confucian teaching, which developed during the Taisho and Showa eras, was excessively constrained by political realities and could not evolve into a tolerant and rich intellectual system. Because he was too closely aligned with the trajectory of emperor state nationalism, his arguments revealed a lack of intellectual flexibility. However, the very essence of Confucian study itself has always been deeply tied to political and social elements, as exemplified by the idea of self-cultivation and governance of others. Given Confucianism's inherently strong practical nature, the path taken by Sinology after the Meiji, such as Hattori's, was one of the possible outcomes. The most politically significant manifestation of Hattori's view of Confucianism, which was criticized for aligning too closely with the trajectory of emperor state nationalism, was likely the Confucian Way Conference held at Yushima Seido in 1935 after the Great Kanto earthquake. This conference was organized to commemorate the reconstruction of Yushima Seido after the Great Kanto earthquake, bringing together Confucian scholars not only from Japan's colonies, Korea and Taiwan, but also from Manchuria and China, with the aim of envisioning peace in East Asia based on Confucian Way. At that time, Hattori, who was vice president of the Shibunkai, Society for This Culture of Ours, and the director of the Japan Manchuria Cultural Association, delivered the closing address, in which he asserted that the foundation of East Asian culture, which had become the subject of Eastern studies as a result of war, was a fusion of Chinese culture and Japan's national spirit, and that this fusion was precisely what constituted Confucian Way. Moreover, he claimed that Confucian Way was not only effective in supporting the modern Japanese emperor state, but could also play a major role in achieving world peace during the crisis following World War I. Since Confucian Way had been reconstructed by modern Japan, world peace too could be realized under the leadership of Imperial Japan. In this way, the philosophy of empire took shape within the realm of Chinese philosophy in modern Japan. So, let us now turn to Takase Takejiro. He was a student of Nemoto Tsumei, a sinologist of ancient Chinese texts such as the Analects and the Book of Changes, and once again, Inoue Tetsujiro, with a particularly strong influence from the latter, Inoue. His first book, Japanese Yanmin Studies, Yanmin means Wanyanmin Studies, published in 1898, included a preface by Inoue Tetsujiro, and it was published prior to Inoue's own book, A Study of the Japanese Yanmin School. Takase played a significant role in fact, Ogyu Shigehiro, in his modality Asia and Yanmin Studies, later formulated as Modern Yanmin Studies. After becoming professor at Kyoto Imperial University in 1907, he was also closely connected to the Osaka Yanmin Society led by Ishizaki Togoku, but he later parted ways with the group. This separation was due to the fact that the Osaka Yanmin Society, as a movement unfolding in the private sphere, came to adopt a socialist tendency and certain religious aspects, positions that Takase, like Inoue, stood firmly against. However, Takase's intellectual interest extended beyond modern Yanmin studies. In 1902, he published Yanmo Philosophy, Yanzi Mo's Ancient Chinese Scholars. The essay Mo's Philosophy, contained within this volume, was written around the same time as Kuaki Genyoku's An Outline of the Development of Ancient Chinese Logical Thought, indicating Takase's keen awareness of the rediscovery of Mozu in the modern era. Nevertheless, Takase and Kuaki pursued different directions. While Kuaki emphasized logic as a branch of philosophy, Takase focused on the similarities between Mozu and Christianity. Christianity, once again, asserting that Christianity is the Mozu teaching of the West, and Mozu is the Christianity of the East. Sueoka Hiroshi described Takase's interpretive approach as follows. So this one. As noted earlier, Mo's philosophy and Yan's philosophy, two of them would be included later in Yanmo philosophy, do not contain explicit conclusions, but the intent behind Takase Takejiro's Yanmo philosophy is evident in its preface and in Inoue Tetsujiro's introductory remarks. That is, he perceives the decline of the Zhou dynasty when the idea of Yanju and Mozu were prevalent and analogous to the crisis of his own time. He criticizes Yanju for promoting egoism, that is, utilitarianism at that day, hedonism and instinctualism, while he attacks Mozu for advocating indiscriminate universal love, akin to that of Christian missionaries, ultimately seeking to promote moderate ethics. The egoism and universal love that Takase criticized, as noted by Takahashi Toru, correspond to the egoism of Kato Hiroyuki, who was highly influential at the time and the universal love of Christian missionaries. The moderate ethics that Takase championed in opposition to egoism and the universal love was the ethical theory of Confucianism as represented by Confucius and Mencius. He thus espoused a nationalist view, stating, we should rather believe that we exist for the sake of the nation, okay? And that it is our natural duty to always contribute to the nation and love humanity. This nationalist critique of Kato Hiroyuki and Christian missionaries was also a well-known position of Takase's mentor, Inoue Tetsujiro, who wrote the preface to his work. In this sense, Takase functioned as a spokesperson for Inoue's ideas. The source of their shared sense of crisis was their perception that egoism led to the general public's aversion to war, while Christianity fostered anti-war sentiments. In short, during the interwar period between the First Sino-Japanese War and the Russo-Japanese War, Takase criticized Mozu for its resemblance to Christianity, which he associated with anti-war discourse. Following the Uchimura Kanzo's disrespect incident of 1891, which occurred the year after the issuance of the imperial rescript on education, and the subsequent publication of Inoue Tetsujiro's The Conflict Between Education and Religion in 1983, criticism of Christianity as a religion had already intensified. In place of religion, Inoue advocated for national morality, and modern Yanmin studies became an important discourse supporting this ideology. Takase's critique of Mozu was formulated within this context. His later expulsion from public office in 1946 was a direct consequence of this ideological trajectory. Another major work by Takase was Lao Zhuang's philosophy. Takase was appointed assistant professor at Kyoto Imperial University in 1907 after serving as a lecturer at Tokyo Imperial University. He traveled to China in 1912 and then to Europe, returning to Japan in 1915. Thus, Lao Zhuang philosophy was written before this series of study abroad experiences. Even so, Takase engaged in a detailed examination of contemporary European research on the Laos. The focus of this research was a question characteristic of 19th century European Orientalism: how to interpret Eastern text within the framework of philology and comparative studies. More concretely, this question manifested in various debates about the origins of the Laos, whether it originated in India, the Orient, or was indigenous to China. Takase referenced figures such as Jean-Pierre Abel Lemusa and Pierre Lafitte from France, Paul Keras from the United States, and Robert Douglas from Britain. One example is Robert Douglas, so Pierre Lafitte, Paul Keras, and Robert Douglas, who argued for an Indian origin of the Laos. Douglas entered King's College, London in 1857, where he studied Chinese under James Summers. Summers was a scholar of Chinese and Japanese studies who welcomed the Iwakura mission to London in 1872. The following year, he came to Japan as a foreign advisor, teaching at Tokyo Kaisei School, Niigata English School, Osaka English School, and Sapporo Agricultural College, as well as founding his own school, the Obun Seikoku Gakkan. Douglas, on the other hand, worked in diplomacy in China from 1858 to 1864. After returning to Britain, he joined the British Museum in 1865 and in 1872 welcomed the Iwakura mission outside Summers at the museum. When Summers left for Japan in 1873, Douglas succeeded him as a professor of Chinese at King's College while continuing his work at the British Museum. In 1877, he published the catalogue of Chinese books in the British Museum and Confucianism and Taoism, which Takase later studied. In 1892, he became the first head of the newly established Oriental Printed Books and Manuscript Department at the British Museum. In 1898, he also published the catalogue of Japanese printed books in the British Museum, to which Minakata Kumagusu, a biologist, contributed. Douglas permitted Minakata, who had been banned from entering the British Museum, to read books in his office. Douglas, who had significant connections to Japan, critically inherited the research of previous European Orientalists and made the following argument. This one. Like Pythagoras, Lao Tzu was in China the first great awakener and suggester of thought. Unlike Confucius, whose mission it was to revive in a degenerate age the teaching of the ancient sages, Lao Tzu appears to have drawn his inspirations from abroad. Every part of his system, from its first conception down to its minutest details, is distinctly Brahminical, and the materials for the interpretation of the Tao Te Ching, the Lao Tzu, must therefore be looked for not in the early books of the Chinese, but in the writings of the Indian philosophers, more especially of the Vedanta school. Takase himself cited this passage. Here, Douglas, building upon Abel Remusat's hypothesis of a Pythagorean origin, asserted that an Indian origin was more appropriate for the Lao Tzu. Takase was thus compelled to grapple with the framework of European Orientalism at that time. In other words, European Orientalism was fundamentally concerned with how to render the non-European world intelligible within its own discourse, particularly in relation to the problem of antiquity before the creation of the world in Christian theology. Since the Lao Tzu was considered one of the oldest texts in this context, its classification significantly impacted the interpretation of Chinese philosophy. Takase, too, engaged with this question of origins within the global circulation of Eastern or Oriental studies. Conclusion. The above discussion has examined two scholars of Chinese philosophy, Hattori and Takase. Not only did they teach at Tokyo Imperial University and Kyoto Imperial University, but they were also actively involved in activities outside the university. The influence of these two contemporaries was extremely significant. This influence stemmed from their efforts to organize Chinese philosophy as the philosophy of the empire, which became the ideological foundation for what would be known later as state Shinto. However, it is important to note that neither of them was simple-minded nationalist who remained confined within Japan. Both were international intellectuals representative of their time, as evidenced by their international experience and the international nature of their scholarship. Nevertheless, or perhaps because of this, they worked to elevate the Japanese Empire and establish its national morality. Post-war Japanese studies of Chinese philosophy began anew by completely rejecting their tendencies. These studies focused almost exclusively on empirical philology, with little emphasis on morality or ethics. In the 21st century, we stand at a crossroads. Should we maintain empirical philology as it is, or should we envision Chinese philosophy as part of world philosophy and take responsibility for its sins and responsibilities? Thank you so much.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.